Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. And this is Bookworm. I'm very happy to be about to talk to Victoria Chang about her book for young people. What is the age group of this book, Victoria?
You know, I think it's around maybe 8 years old to 13 years old. So it's middle grade, what they call middle grade.
Yes. The book is called Love, Love. And, of course, I was excited because it's a novel written entirely in poetic lines and, at the same time, again, the fear of poetry that might enter is completely abolished by the clarity and directness with which it's written. Now, you had written a picture book before this that was a Times Notable Book of the Year, Victoria. This is new for you, yes?
Yes, yes. I have two children, and they're 13 and 11 now. And as they've grown, I've had to sort of read books or learn more about what books are available to children. And because I write adult poetry and am a writer, occasionally I'll have these ideas where I want to try that too. And so these books, the children's books, are a result of that.
Love, Love excited me particularly as I read to learn that its title has as much to do with the opening score of Tennis as it does to do with the love between two sisters. They have been drawn apart by an experience. One sister at first seems to be getting more attention than the other at school. The other one is shy, overweight, but then the preferred sister, her hair starts falling out, is the way it's presented. One can find her hair between the pages of her books, in particular at the exciting sections of the Nancy Drew books that both sisters love to read, and that the younger sister, Frances, practically has to steal from her older sister and read at night with flashlight because her older sister is not a sharer, is not generous in that way. In fact, that is the subject of this book. What will get these children to share? How will they share their inner worlds with one another? Now, you're a poet, and people are used to poets being, what would you say, profound, enigmatic, difficult. And you've written a book entirely in poetry and for children to understand directly. What was that like?
It was incredibly fun because so much of poetry is about really sometimes difficult metaphor, which is really a leap, right? A metaphor is a big jump. Even similes are a jump. And so I think that writing children's was just another challenge to writing two children or four children and really thinking about the things that they can understand and then trying to figure out how to write them and challenge them in imagistic, poetic, literary ways, emotional ways, philosophical ways, but yet still make it easy enough and legible enough so that they can have a really good experience and not be too stuck. And so finding that balance was really hard, but I really thought it was a fun experience for me because I had never written a verse novel before and written for children in this age group. And so the challenge was what appealed to me.
Well, the book is dedicated to my human children, Penny and Winnie, and to my wiener dog children, Mustard and Ketchup. And you tell in this dedication, to all the bullied kids in the world, I see you. To all the kids who suffer, I see you. And the important thing is to be seen. It's a rarity. It's a very rich experience. How did your children respond to the book?
They haven't read it. I think that they just, I hear them talk. So sometimes they talk to their friends, and once in a while, like just last night, I heard one of them say, oh yeah, she's an author. She's a poet. She writes books. So I think they talk about me, but I'm not sure they know exactly what it is that I do. So I'll give, my children copies of my books and sign them even. And I know they don't read them, and I'll ask them why sometimes. And they say, they don't have a good explanation, but they'll say, oh, I think it'll be too sad. Or they try and say something that would make me feel better, when in reality, I just don't think they're interested. I imagine them maybe reading them when I'm dead, to be morbid, like a poet can be, that they'll be more interested in kind of everything about my mind and how it works and how I saw the world, in the same way that I'm curious about how my mother thought about things, who passed, in 2015. So I do think that my hope is I'll leave things for them and they can read them or not, when they're ready.
I discovered your work recently, but it seems as if you've led many lives. And in particular, you seem to have been involved in hedge funds and stocks and the business world. Is that so?
Oh, yeah, I do have an MBA from Stanford. And so I did get a business degree, and I have worked at an investment bank, at a management consulting firm. I worked at lots of different places. I was just sort of doing what other people were doing, if that makes sense. I followed a group of people that I had met at Harvard, where I was for graduate school. And they just told me, oh, you should do this or do that. So, I was, I think, more impressionable when I was younger. And just because you're good at something doesn't mean you should do it. So I think it's just sort of finding your own voice is a process in my life that I'm still finding or trying to find. And now I'm more comfortable sort of figuring out what it is exactly do you like to do versus what can you do? What are you capable of? And so I think that time of my life was more about just not knowing what I was really interested in, or not really understanding that you could be a writer because my parents weren't born here. So it's not like they knew there was such a thing, and so I didn't really know there was such a thing. So it took me a while to figure out that you could be a writer in some ways. A lot of writers also have other jobs and things, but there's still a possibility that one could lead a very rich, creative inner world through writing, and pushing it outward through books and things like that, that I just really didn't know existed. We didn't have a lot of books in our house. And if they were books, there were like encyclopedias or Chinese books, and our library just started to accumulate as children based on the books that we read, not the books that my parents read because, they spoke Chinese at home. So those were all sorts of things that I had to figure out maybe more gradually than someone who might have had, parents that were born in this country.
Was it in part an attempt to live up to parental expectations. I know that in Asian families, like Jewish families, like mine, there are a lot of expectations of what the children should be. Were you facing that as well?
Absolutely. I mean, it was always about who was going to this college or that college. And it's, you know, because they didn't come here with anything in their pockets. And they had put a lot of their dreams into their children. And at the time, it felt a little bit oppressive. I mean, I was lucky. I had an older sister who's brilliant. I still have an older sister. She's only 14 months older than me, but she's so brilliant and so compliant. And so she did whatever my parents wanted her to. And so I, as the second child, a close second child, was very rambunctious and, you know, just kind of askew, I would say. My brain just doesn't work like my sister's brain. I just kind of did whatever I wanted to. And I rebelled, I resisted, I was very creative. You know, making money and earning one's own living was very important to my mother, who's very feminist, actually. You know, my grandmother apparently was an educator, and that's also very unusual. And my mother was highly educated and incredibly intelligent and brilliant and artistic and all these things, but she never got to realize her dreams because she didn't speak the language here. And she used to say that she felt like she could have been something if she had stayed in her own country, two countries, actually. She was born in China, and then she moved to Taiwan after the war. And so I think there's a lot for my mom left on the table. And so I felt that pressure, as immigrant children can, to live up to those expectations. But at some point, I just sort of, you know, I think making money was sort of what I understood that to be. But I always pursued my own writing because I could not pursue my own writing. It's just who I am. And so I think she'd be really proud of me, though, if she were still alive, because I think she would have changed her ways a little bit too. I think she had started to. I had the chance to show her some of my books, you know, and she was so happy to see that I was doing something artistic, which I think she always really liked to do as well.
My parents were always afraid that there wouldn't be a living for someone like me. And I think however many children there are in the family, the creative child is the one who suffers from parental fear that you have chosen the impossible career. I'm talking to Victoria Chang. And this occasion, we spoke last week about her book of prose poetry, Obit. This week, we're talking about her children's novel, written entirely in verse, published by Sterling. But not only is she a poet, a writer of children's books, but she has also come to be the head of the Antioch program in Los Angeles, the Low Residency Program. What is a Low Residency Program?
I'm happy to explain that to you. All it means is that most of the work that students do in their MFA, which is a Master's in Fine Arts, two-year program, is off-site. It's remote. So it's low residency, meaning you only have to come twice a year for 10 days each. So in June and in December, we have these really high octane, high energy 10-day residencies where we have faculty, speakers, guests, seminars, workshops, all jam-packed in 10 days. And then we match our students with mentors or faculty members, and they go off for the next 6 months and work with them online and exchanging creative work and doing their assignments and things like that. So that the low part of that is, you know, if you think about it, like it's just a partial residency. So it's really meant for, you know, people who maybe don't want to move or people who have jobs. It gives that kind of flexibility to adult learners and adult writers.
I noticed that you studied at Warren Wilson, which has a very famous low residency program.
Yeah, I did go there. And it's the same reason. And it was the sort of immigrant child in me. I had gotten into some really great programs like the Houston MFA program. And Ed Hirsch was there teaching at the time. But I loved my job, and I also didn't want to lose my income. And that was sort of my mom's voice in my head. And so Warren Wilson gave me a really nice fellowship.
Well, it's fascinating to me that you've been able to do this. I think in my experience, and I've been talking to writers for 31 years, this is very rare. You are no longer in business. You are a writer, a poet, and a teacher, yes?
Yeah, and I stopped doing anything related to that and even turned down various things that have come up in business since then because I won a Guggenheim Fellowship. And at that point, I thought to myself, these other people are investing in me, but I'm not investing in me. And so that's when I thought, maybe I should decide to invest more in my own creativity and my own writing versus stealing minutes away from all these other things that didn't really relate to my writing.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to KCRW's Bookworm. I'm talking with Victoria Chang, poet and now the author of a children's book written entirely in poetry called Love, Love. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Victoria Chang about her new book, Love, Love, the story of a Chinese-American girl experiencing the realities of a suburban Detroit school, written in verse. Now, in this book, it's the sister's hair, and it's quite a thing. She's teased about it. She has a bald spot. She gets a wig. Mean kids, and there's no dearth of them anywhere, mean kids steal her wig and hide it. It's really, I learned from your author's note, part of a problem that isn't talked about, that is only starting to have its language. What is the name of this disease?
It's called trichotillomania, and usually people say trick, T-R-I-C-H, for short.
And what is it?
It's when people, for whatever reason, pull out various hair on their body. So it could be off of their head, it could be eyelashes, hair in other parts of one's body obsessively. And it's almost as if they can't not do it. And that's sort of what I grew up, so much of my childhood, I remember our family trying to figure it out and what the problems were. And so it's not really talked about that much. But I think once you start talking about it and you start learning about it, you realize how many people experience this or have experienced it in their lives. And you can read about forums where people talk about it. And I spent a lot of time reading because it helped me understand my sister better, which growing up, none of us did. And to this day, it's still hard, but I think reading what other people have to say about their own experiences with trichotillomania really helped me sort of understand my sister and also maybe even forgive myself, for wanting all the things that siblings might want that they didn't have, things like attention or, children are jealous of each other. And so my sister was always better and smarter and more favored. And I was kind of, and because of the trichotillomania, maybe more focused on. As a parent now, I think I finally understand why, the older child might seem more favored, because it's the first child and all the experiences are newer. And then if there's anything wrong, then all the attention that the parents sort of like goes to that child, like a bee, you know, might go to a flower, you know, to use a cliche. So I see that now as a parent. And so it's just, you know, kind of learning about all of this. It helped me to write this. It kind of almost made me want to write this because I still wanted to capture how a child might feel in that kind of family.
The things you're talking about, it gets covered up in the family. They don't mm-hmm. want to talk about it. And so it becomes very difficult to deal with. And one of the things that children's books, especially books for this age group from 8 to 13, it's very useful when language is provided to talk about the inner wordless experiences that we all have.
Right. And I think that's so true because I think that inner wordless experience as a child, it's you feel so many things, but you just don't have the language yet to express it. And then sometimes you're in families that as adults, they don't have the language either. And so you're just trapped in a cyclone of sorrow, confusion, and silence. And I think silence is the most sinister thing. And as a parent, I try so hard not to, you know, replicate that. And I try and talk more about feelings or things. And but I still think I see, you know, my own 13 and 11, they still have that sort of natural inclination towards secrecy and silence. And I think that's just a part of growing up.
While the ostensible fact is the gradual loss of hair, the underlying constant reference is that we are in a Chinese American family, an immigrant family, who don't know how to talk to each other about these things. And I thought the most beautiful chapter of the book took the mother to school to teach children how to make egg rolls. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, Frances is very frightened of what's going to happen when her mother comes to school. But instead, the kids are very impressed and grateful and wish that they could be helping the mother the way Frances is helping her. She experiences a real moment of external pride in being part of the family she was born into. It's a beautiful chapter. It moved me very deeply.
Well, thank you. You know, kids who are different, and so many kids are, and then you add on top of this sort of, you know, being kind of one of the only Asian people in our community, it's hard. And I think that just you spend so much of your life doing what other people just do naturally, which is just accept yourself for who you are. And I wonder all the time what it would be like to grow up in Asia, anywhere in Asia, just to have people who look like me being sort of everywhere. Because, and I've heard people from Asia say this, so you American Chinese or American Asians spend so much time thinking about this thing that we don't. And they'll say it's this identity thing, you know, and we just don't think about that as much. And I was thinking about that recently, how what a privilege and luxury not to have to think about it. But on the other hand, what a privilege and luxury for me to be able to navigate the world in such a unique way that was my fate, you know, for whatever reason. And so I'll make the most of that experience, even though it's been a very difficult experience. And I think that, you know, writing is a way to sort of navigate it, but also to, you know, gift my experiences to other people that might be experiencing something similar.
Part of being a reader is the willingness to understand the world. And part of being a reader of poetry is the willingness to understand the deep roots in the unconscious of experience as it gropes for language. It's a thrilling thing. And you are, I have to tell you, to my mind, a master of the process. Mistress? Both.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it is. And I think about it now too, in the world that our children are growing up in, is that they have all these food days where people are encouraged to bring in, you know, tamales that they made with their grandmother last night. Or it's so different now growing up in California. It's lovely to see, you know, that my children don't necessarily have to have that same experience as I did, but they still, you know, will experience certain things similar, because people can just, children and people in general can be cruel. But yeah, that is a big part of that book, is that finding that kind of redemption and pride and joy in one's heritage and background that the main character, Frances, just, you know, obviously didn't have, because she was ruthlessly bullied growing up and I was. And so I think that it was fun to write that chapter and to sort of change things so that she, you know, it's fictionalized. So it was fun to make Frances have sort of a more positive experience than I did growing up.
I still think myself, you know, just being a reading child, an articulate child, one comes in for one's own share of ridicule. You're not supposed to be able to do that. A smart kid isn't supposed to act smart in school. You're supposed to keep it hidden. And this book, Love, Love, is about the end of secrecy, ultimately. And I think it's very beautiful. Thank you, Victoria, for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
I've been talking with Victoria Chang, the author of Love, Love, and of the book of poetry, Obit. Love, Love is published by Sterling Children's Books. What a book, what an experience to read someone who has grown past the world of successful business and investment instruction to the world of poetry, and further into the world of poetry for children. Hers is a very interesting development. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show. And it's also available at Apple, Spotify, all the other podcast services. You can even listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to co-producer Sean Sullivan, who faced extraordinary difficulties in getting this done today. Associate producer Alan Howard, who could have stayed at home, and I'm so glad he was here. Technical director Mario Diaz, who I'm sure was biting his nails to the quick, hoping that we'd get to the end, and we have, which is, I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Andre Nafis-Saheli is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.